Well, you sound great. So if you are ready, we can go ahead and start.
Okay.
Good. I'm speaking with Patricia Churchland, whose new book is Touching a Nerve, the Self as Brain. Patricia, a few years ago, The New Yorker published a profile of you and your husband, Paul Church, fellow philosopher. And this article raised a basic question about what is thinking? And I thought that would actually be a good place to start for us. What do you think thinking is?
Yes. Well, it's probably fairly complicated, at least because it's like the word weeds. You know, there's so many different kinds of weeds, and it kind of depends a little bit on what you're interested in if you're a gardener. And I think there are many different kinds of thinking, so that sometimes what we do is rehearse an event that happened that may be bothering us or that we may enjoy. Other times we might be trying to solve a problem, like, why is the dog limping? And sometimes what we want to do is plan ahead. So we're thinking, well, I'm going to put in the garden, and should I put the tomatoes here? Well, no, because I had them there last year. So there's planning, there's rehearsing, and sometimes there's also visual imagery that goes along with these things. So sometimes when we think, it's highly verbal, and it's kind of like we're talking to ourselves or having a conversation with ourselves. But sometimes it's very visual, full of emotions, maybe even other kinds of sensory images, maybe olfactory, maybe auditory. There are people who are very musical who have very rich and very precise auditory imagery.
So thinking does not necessarily involve language.
No, it doesn't. Although I have to say that there was a long time when people who did cognitive psychology found it much easier to approach the problem of what thinking is if they assumed that it had to be within language. But it clearly is not, because many non-verbal animals can do problem solving, have expectations. Babies, before they are fully linguistic, also are clearly doing such things as rehearsing or expecting or wondering or puzzling about something. And that has to be in nonverbal form. And probably the deepest form of thinking is nonverbal, because after all, language is a fairly recent development in our evolutionary history.
That raises a question. What is the deepest kind of thinking? You're sort of raising this this idea that there are different levels of thinking.
There certainly are. But, you know, here is where I get a bit faint-hearted, because there are some problems in neuroscience where I think we've made quite a lot of progress. Problems having to do, for example, with the nature of vision and how it is that we can see in colors, just to take a simple example. Or a question about what actually changes in the brain when somebody becomes addicted to, let's say, heroin. But thinking, I think, is one of those problems that we will address once neuroscience gets much further along. So I think neurobiologically, we don't have a lot to say at this point about mechanism, about what's actually going on if someone is using visual imagery to solve, say, a problem about how to fix something. So I think that it's one of those really, really important and interesting problems that we'll get to, but we're certainly not there yet. So I would like to be able to tell you more about it, but alas, I can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to talk some about your own background and how you became a philosopher of mind, because it's an interesting story. I know, for instance, that you were studying philosophy at Oxford University, but you sort of became discouraged then, didn't you?
I did. I was a graduate student at Oxford studying philosophy, which in the 1960s was thought to be kind of the place with the great cachet to study philosophy. But it was all about what words meant. And I thought, well, that's all very interesting, and it's nice to be clear about what you mean. But on the other hand, I want to understand what decision making really is. I don't just want to understand what you mean by it. Let's agree on that. But now I want to know what it is. And philosophers, by and large, until really very recently, took the view that you can understand as much as you really need to understand by paying attention to the words, and don't worry too much about this other question about the nature of the phenomenon. And I found that very discouraging. And so once Paul and I had jobs...
Paul, your husband.
Paul is my husband. Once we had jobs, and this was in Canada, and at the city called Winnipeg, famous for the Winnipeg Jets hockey team. I'll just slip that in there. Once we had jobs there, I went down to the medical school and talked to the anatomists, the neuroanatomists, and said, you know, I really feel that I want to understand the brain to the degree that we do understand it so that I can approach questions about the mind, about how we reason or remember, why we sleep and dream, what it is to be conscious. But I know I need to understand the brain. And that was kind of the beginning of this long journey that was so wonderful and so exciting and such fun.
And I'm guessing that was pretty unusual for a philosopher to go to the medical school and wanting to learn about neuroanatomy. Probably not too many other philosophers were interested in the science of the brain.
No, it's quite true. It was rather unusual, and I think it was fortunate that I was at Winnipeg, where people were used to lots of eccentricity and didn't think it was a terrible thing for me to do. On the other hand, within the profession of philosophy, many people, I think, thought I was just nuts. And that if you want to understand the mind, you don't need to know anything about the brain. And part of the reason they said this, and this was really a very strong idea, was that the mind is like the software and the brain is like the hardware. And just as if you want to understand what's wrong with your word processing application, you pay attention not to the nuts and bolts of the machine, but to the software. So you don't need to know anything about the brain in order to understand the mind.
Mm. Well, it strikes me there has been just a huge sea change since then. I mean, hardly any serious scholars, including philosophers, would say that you can really talk about the mind without at least making reference to the brain. I mean, you sort of can't separate the mind from the brain.
It's pretty hard now, I think. It was easier 25 years ago. But it's very difficult now to say that because there are such tight correlations between changes in the brain and changes in psychological states, such as remembering or making a decision. And you know, I think that the first bit of neuroscience that really blew this all wide open were the split brain results, where patients with intractable epilepsy underwent a surgery whereby the two hemispheres of the brain were separated. And the astonishing thing was that there was what's called a disconnection syndrome, and that is one hemisphere might have access to information that the other didn't, and that had an effect on behavior. Given that, it was very hard for anybody to say, you know, well, there's really a soul in there, you know, a ghosty thing in there that somehow has also become disconnected. And I think the split brain results were tremendously important, and then many, many other things followed on after that.
Well, you have gone on to pioneer this relatively new field that has been called neurophilosophy. But I'm wondering if you kind of ever think that if you could do it over again, would you have become a neuroscientist instead of a philosopher?
You know, it's always hard to imagine yourself back because what exactly do you imagine? That it was the same situation as when you were actually there? Or if I were, say, 21 now, would I go into neuroscience? I think the answer is probably if I were 21 now, I would go into neuroscience. but and as both my children actually have. Hmm. And I think neuroscience, of course, is a huge field with many levels at which people study nervous systems. So there's many, many questions that people can address and make progress on. And I think that the really sharp people in psychology, philosophy, biology are going into neuroscience because it's so exciting. It's the new frontier.
Well, it raises the question of whether philosophy has anything to add to the study of the mind or the brain, or is all the action really in science, in neuroscience?
Well, of course, philosophy covers many things beyond philosophy of mind. And so there are people who think a lot about the history of philosophy, including Asians such as Confucius and Mencius, as well as the Greeks like Aristotle and Plato. So there's certainly something to be done there. But within the domain of philosophy of mind, my view is that if you really want to make progress, then you need to pay attention to the science. Now, the science might be quite high level and might involve mostly behavior, or it might be very low level and involve molecules that have to do with how information is stored and retrieved. But if you think that you can answer questions, for example, about the nature of decision-making, without knowing anything about the psychology and the neurobiology of decision-making, you're probably deluding yourself.
Well, it seems like you're kind of making the case against the philosophy of mind here. You're suggesting that, well, we should just all be scientists. We should follow the lead of what the scientists are learning about the brain.
Well, here's one way to think of it. Sort of, you know, put it in the long line of history. And, of course, at the very earliest stages of Aristotle, for example, everything that was an object of knowledge was part of philosophy. So by the time we get to, say, the Enlightenment, what we see is that as the science really begins to take off and develop, it hives itself off of natural philosophy and becomes a science in its own right. And that's, of course, what happened to chemistry. So Lavoisier thought of himself as a natural philosopher. Faraday, who really uncovered so much about the nature of electricity and made it possible to harness electricity so that we now have all these wonderful devices, Faraday called himself a natural philosopher. But, of course, now people would call him a physicist. And so I think what we see in the history of science is that as a phenomenon becomes more and more amenable to scientific techniques, then it kind of hives itself off the sort of mother discipline, if you like.
So maybe you are one of the last of the natural philosophers.
Well, unless you want to think that we're all natural philosophers, all of us physicists and chemists and engineers and so forth. And I think it's kind of a nice way to think about it, because one of the wonderfully interesting developments, especially in the last 20 years, has been how hitherto separated disciplines have found it so useful to come together. And so genetics and molecular biology, for example, and biochemistry are very tight. But, of course, genetics and neuroscience have places where they are very tight and so forth. And so the boundaries between disciplines are increasingly fuzzy, and that's very exciting in its own way.
Well, I want to talk about some of the specific issues that you explore in your book, Touching a Nerve, the Self is Brain. For instance, you raise the question, is genocide in our genes? Mm-hmm. What made you think about this?
Well, I think there were two things. One is that there is a kind of tendency when people see a behavior that is common to say, well, it must be in the genes. And very often the behavior in question can be highly modified, because the brain is so changeable as a function of experience, that the behavior is highly modifiable by the environment and by the way experience impinges on the brain. And so one of the things that you want to think about when the question of genes comes up is, okay, let's just take that idea seriously and let's, you know, roll up our sleeves and see what the heck is really there. Now, many people have argued that war is in our genes. And so that was one of the cases where I thought, well, let's just find out what we actually know about genes and aggression. And that led me to this work on the fruit fly that I talk about. Now, you might think, well, a fruit fly, how, you know, except that if you can't get a simple genetic story of the relation between genes and aggression in the fruit fly, what makes you think you're going to get a simple story in mammals, or especially in humans?
Yeah.
So the story in the fruit fly is that there are many, many, many genes that play some sort of role, unknown, in aggressive behavior in fruit flies. It's mainly in males who compete for females, you know, and they fight little guys. You know, it's actually kind of interesting to watch. But it turns out that there are many genes, and there is no simple relationship. That genes form these complicated networks with each other, and they interact with the environment to change gene expression, which also changes then what growth and development happens in the brain. So there's this wonderful interaction between genes, environment, and brain structures that remains to be understood and unraveled. But, you know, to think, well, there's a gene for mums to stay at home and take care of babies, or, you know, there's a gene for not having abortions. Well, you know, probably not.
Well, and there's,
it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, and there's also been this effort to look to various peoples who are not part of modern civilization to sort of see, okay, so are they,
yeah,
you know, inherently violent or not?
And yes,
and,
yes.
And you write, for instance, about two very different cultures, the Inuit and the Yanomamo, and they have extremely different behaviors, especially when it comes to raiding in war. Can you spell out those differences?
Yes. Genetically, the Inuit who live in the Arctic and the Yanomamo who live in Brazil, genetically they're indistinguishable as they would be from me. But the Yanomamo appear to be fairly warlike, and they go on these raids to neighboring camps and kill people and steal women and cause havoc and so forth. And male children are brought up to be part of that, and they dress themselves up in these ways that signify that they are warriors, and they learn to use spears and so forth. So it's really, you know, a part of the way they are. The Inuit, by contrast, probably because their ecology is so harsh and they have to be so careful, are not warlike at all. Now, they are certainly capable of killing others if they have to, but there is a cultural downplaying of aggression within the group. And it's really frowned upon. And as a consequence, people find other ways of easing tensions, of dealing with competition within the group and so forth. And when they come together with others in these big summer festivals, they manage to get along fairly well. Now, it doesn't mean that there's never murder, and it doesn't mean that they never kill one another, but they never do seem to engage in warfare.
And you're saying this is basically because of the radically different environments they live in? I mean, one environment being kind of Arctic-like, very barren, harsh, and the other, the rainforest.
Yes. I mean, you know, let me just put it in slightly crude terms. I mean, in the rainforest, you've got lots of foliage and trees, and you can sneak around without being seen. Whereas in the Arctic, the settlements are spread out, and you're going to be seen if you go trekking from your settlement to the neighbors. Why? Well, there's no trees, and the dogs are going to set up an alarm, and it's very easy to see somebody from a very long distance away. So it would be hard to do any sneaking around. And it's also not clear what the benefits of warfare would be. I mean, what would you do? What's it for? Well, in the case of the Yanomamo, they would get goods as well as females, and they would feel good about the revenge for previous infractions. In the case of the Inuit, there's really, you know, they had, until very recently, they didn't really have much worth stealing. And if you wanted to trade a certain kind of tool, well, you could do that, but they didn't have much worth stealing. And so there wasn't really much point in raids between settlements, but keeping competition and violence within the settlement at a very low level was of primary importance because you could endanger the whole group. And these people were, until very recently, always living on the knife edge of starvation. And so to do stupid things like kill other members of the group who are good hunters is not in your interest.
Now, another issue that you explore is this classic philosophical problem. Do we have free will? And
it, uh-huh.
As you point out, a lot rides on how we define free will. How do you define it?
Well, I like to think of decision-making, which is really the ambit of free will. I like to think of decision-making as involving varying kinds of control. So some, you might think of this as a very simple case of a decision, but from the point of view of the brain, a decision is, for example, a reflex. You make a noise over to my right, my eyes turn and my head turns automatically. On the other hand, of course, I could control that. So if I know that you are up to no good and you want me to turn my head, I can steadfastly look away in the direction I'm currently looking. So there are levels and levels and levels of control. And we know that control can be compromised by many things. If I'm very tired and very hungry, my control is apt to be poorer than if I'm rested and fully satisfied. And we also know that control can be compromised by certain drugs like heroin or cannabis or alcohol and so forth. And so I think it's important to put the whole idea of free will in the context of control and the mechanisms for control. Now, the sad fact is, of course, that at this stage of neuroscience, there's so much about the details of the mechanisms for control that we don't really understand.
But you know, there is this spate of new books that have come out, especially by neuroscientists, who say that we don't have free will. It's an illusion that, you know, everything is just brain chemistry ultimately, or, you know, what's happening at the level of our neurons and, you know, what the brain does is causes us to act in particular ways. So let's just get rid of the whole idea of free will. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that it's kind of a mistake. It's a mistake because there are real differences, real brain differences between when I am in control and when I'm not in control. And those differences are relevant in the social context when we want to take into account whether I should be responsible for something. So if, for example, I was sleepwalking and I trash your car, then you may not want to hold me responsible because I wasn't in control in the full sense. So those differences, excuse me, those differences need to be taken into account in the sort of very broad context of responsibility. Now, of course, it's true that events in the brain are all causally related, but that doesn't mean that there is no such thing as a difference in control, so that someone who is an alcoholic and is terribly drunk has much less motor control and can't walk a straight line than someone who is stone cold sober.
But I think the way this translates to most people is, given two choices in front of us, can we choose one or the other? Or is there something inside of us that is sort of pushing us to make that decision for us? I mean, I don't know, at the unconscious level or something like that. I mean, do we actually have free will to make that choice?
Well, if you think by we, the we here, let's just use a different pronoun. Let's say the I here. I am a product of my brain. There is no difference between the me that I am and the brain that I have. So my sense of self and my sense of being an agent who can do things is all something that emerges from the way the brain organizes itself to efficiently behave and get itself around the planet. So when you say, is there something causing me to do this behavior, I want to say, well, the brain is a causal machine, so causal effects are in place, of course, but that doesn't mean that there is no difference between someone who, say, has obsessive compulsive disorder and someone who doesn't. I wash my hands because they're dirty, because I don't have obsessive compulsive disorder. So the way to think about it is not that are we free from all causes, but rather, which are the causes that allow us to be held responsible for what we do and to do what we plan and we organize and what's in our interest to do? Are there differences between those causes and the causes that where we don't, we say, I wish I didn't have to go back and check the stove, but I just have to? And the answer is yes. There are differences, and we're beginning to understand the nature of those differences. And they involve relations between frontal cortex and subcortical structures.
Hmm. Well, you have a fascinating case study where you talk about some of these issues about free will. You write about a surgeon named Matt Doran who has Tourette's syndrome, right?
Yes, yes, Matt Doran. Yes, a most remarkable man. Oliver Sacks wrote about him in The New Yorker, but the Canadian television company, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, also did a video of him. And he is quite remarkable because his Tourette's, that is, these funny movements that he's sort of compelled to make. He touches his nose, his glasses, the top of his head, his rump, and then he goes through the whole thing again and again and again. Or he'll spit out meaningless words like stupid, stupid, stupid. But when he needs to pay attention to something in a medical context, all of that disappears.
So when he's actually doing surgery, he's fine. None of this behavior surfaces.
None of it emerges. And he was a very, I think he perhaps may be retired now, but he was a very good surgeon. He was admired by the staff. But interestingly, he would finish the surgery, he would walk out, and then instantly begin to tick in this Tourette-ing way very intensively, as though somehow it had kind of built up. And we all kind of know a bit about what that's like because, you know, sometimes you're sitting in a boring lecture and it's going on and on and on, and you scratch here and you scratch there and then you scratch again, and, you know, you kind of, you've got these funny little fidgets that sometimes are hard to suppress. And I think in the case of Tourette's, it's like that, only much, much more intense.
Hmm. So you're saying there's an element of will here, of free will, I guess you could say. I mean,
why not? I mean, he can, with great effort in a non-medical context, he can repress these tics. And in a medical context, they're clearly repressed. So isn't that control, and isn't that different from what it's like for him when he's in a non-medical context and, you know, his hands are flying all over the place? And I think the answer is yes. Now, there's so much about control, you know, that we don't really understand because some of it, of course, is non-conscious. I mean, think about when you're talking. And here I am talking to you on the radio. Well, I have to be fairly controlled. I can't say all kinds of just stupid things. And yet I don't rehearse what I'm going to say. It just flows out. So there are non-conscious mechanisms in there that make sure that I don't cuss or what have you. And they're very effective, but I don't have to actually consciously summon those determinations. You know, now when you get on the radio, don't cuss like you usually do. Don't say bloody, bloody, bloody. I don't have to do that. I just don't. My unconscious just kind of takes care of it for me.
I mean, that's fascinating. You raise this example because, I mean, I think most people would assume that when you talk, that is the quintessential conscious behavior. But you're saying speech is actually, a lot of that is actually happening at the unconscious level.
It is. And the way we put words together and the choice of words and even the sort of general gist of what we want to say is often not before us consciously. And I think it is kind of surprising. And on those occasions when you do precisely rehearse what you want to say, like, you know, to the traffic cop, or when you're a very young faculty member, you think that, you know, when you first give a talk, it has to be completely memorized. What happens? Well, it comes out terribly stilted. It sounds phony. It sounds forced. It sounds memorized. If it's spontaneous speech, we recognize that. But spontaneous speech is highly organized and highly controlled and constrained by non-conscious processes. It has to be.
Yeah. Isn't this something that Sigmund Freud realized a long time ago, that speech is largely unconscious?
Ha! You know, I'm not sure that he actually did say that about speech, but certainly he had very interesting thoughts about the non-conscious. I think he was one of the people who recognized that lots of intelligent, I mean, put aside for the moment the idea that it's all about sex, but he was one of the first people to realize that much of what is intelligent must go on non-consciously. So that when you are driving a car and you suddenly recognize that someone is coming at you in the wrong lane, you're not consciously going through every step of the processing where you figure out, oh, that must be a car because it's got two wheels, and that must be a wheel because it's round, and so on and so forth. You don't do that. It's there. And that means that a huge amount of non-conscious processing goes on behind that visual recognition.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I was going to say, and then think about auditory recognition. Here we are talking. And you are understanding in real time what I'm saying. Well, that's your non-conscious working away like crazy.
Hmm. Well, part of what we're talking about here is identity. I mean, what makes me me? And I mean, there's a profound question: is all this unconscious stuff me, or is it really just the conscious stuff that I'm aware of?
That's a wonderful question, and I'm the way I think about it, and other people may think about this in a different way, is that I am all of those, that the non-conscious mechanisms and habits and ways of being that play into the things that I say and the decisions that I make are every bit as part of me as those things that I consciously work out. And I think it's kind of a shock in a way to sort of think that your non-conscious is as smart and as organized and as mechanistic as it actually is, and that what we are is every bit involving both non-conscious and conscious mechanisms, and moreover, that there's no clear line between them.
Well, it seems that there's a huge paradox here because, I mean, just to take one example, creativity. You know, where does creativity come from? I think a lot of people would say, if you talk to a novelist, they'd say, well, you know, I've thought about something, maybe I'm stuck in the novel, you know, I sit on it, and then the idea pops up.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, it pops up from the unconscious. You know, the unconscious is sort of toiling away, sort of working this out, and then it comes to the level of the conscious. So, I mean, you would think, oh, you know, really important stuff happens in the unconscious, and yet, on the other hand, we tend to think of the unconscious as this rote mechanistic thing that happens, that it's not really the important stuff. What is important is, you know, what we're consciously aware of and sort of sort out cognitively. Mm-hmm. And how do we square those two things?
No, I think that's quite right, that there has been this tendency to think that if a behavior emerges from non-conscious processing, that it must be, as they say, automatic, must be kind of like a reflex. And I think that's totally wrong. And the example of speech, of course, is particularly compelling here. So it's probably time for us to begin to think about non-conscious processing, as Freud, but certainly as Helmholtz did also, as involving both very simple mechanisms on the one hand, but also very complex, intelligent, sophisticated information processing mechanisms on the other hand, that there's kind of a continuity, and that it's a mistake to suppose that consciousness is smart, the unconscious is essentially an automatic device. Can't be. And I find that sort of exhilarating in an interesting sort of a way. It gives me a sense of being a whole person in a way that's different if I think of my unconscious as just being this kind of automatic reflex device.
Well, related to this, you tell a fascinating story about a 19th century chemist named Ludwig Staudenmayer, who became obsessed with automatic writing, which seemed to come from his unconscious. Can you tell the story of what he did?
Yes. Well, this is a story that came to light from work done by a German neuroscientist, Peter Brugger. And Staudenmayer was interesting to him because Staudenmayer was a chemist and a rather good chemist. He had a religious background, but as he went to school and began to get very involved in chemistry, he got less and less interested. But at a certain point, someone was talking to him about automatic writing. And so-called automatic writing occurs when you hold the pen and apparently the ghost or your dead mother guides your hand. And so you write these things which are not coming from you, but are actually coming from this alien being. And people got very excited about this sort of form of spiritualism, and they thought they were really talking to the dead. And Staudenmayer initially poo-pooed it, but then he found himself getting more and more involved in it and really believing that his hand was being guided. And eventually he realized that he didn't actually need to hold a pen and write, that the alien beings, the ghosts, the dead mother, would talk to him. And so he began to hear voices. And then he began to feel that he was inhabited by various little people. For example, there was a rather nasty little person who lived in his rectum, of all things. And in any case, he then claimed that when he was at home alone, that buns would fly through the air and plates would fall off at the table. And he thought that it was not himself that was doing this. Now, this is really, really interesting, because one of the things that it brings to mind is this, that when I do something, like I lift a bottle of water, I know without thinking, without reasoning, I know that it's me that did that. But you have to have a whole organization of brain functions in place and doing the right thing in order for you to know that. And in Staudenmayer's case, it looks like over time, the mechanisms that allowed him to know that a behavior was in fact performed by him, those mechanisms began to break down, which of course is characteristic of schizophrenia in its very florid phase. So almost certainly Staudenmayer was schizophrenic. He was probably attracted to spirit writing because he was sinking into schizophrenia. I don't think that it caused the schizophrenia. But the importance of the story really resides in making us realize that things that seem to us dead obvious, like if I throw something, it's me that threw it, that from the point of view of the brain, that all has to be figured out. And there have to be mechanisms, and those mechanisms can sometimes come apart or disintegrate or be dysfunctional. And when they are, it's devastating, as it is in the case of schizophrenia.
That is a great place to leave it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.